to these seminars and how few usually are interested in talking about preaching. But I'm not too surprised at that, because most ministers think they're great preachers and don't need to work on it. The trouble is that the lay people tell us exactly the opposite, that it's the one area where most of us are failing and need a lot of work. But ministers usually don't think that way. I've never met a minister that didn't think he was a great preacher. And yet it's an area that, you know, really requires a tremendous amount of work, and you never end, I don't think, learning and kind of developing your whole skill and gifts in this area. But we don't work at it hard enough, and that's definitely what all the surveys and everything from lay people tell us in just about every denomination that's courageous enough to ask the lay people what they think. The feedback is not good. So I appreciate your being here and the fact that you're interested in preaching. I thought maybe it might be just helpful, because I don't know you and you don't know me very well, maybe just go around and tell us a little bit about your background, the church you're at, is it, you know, what the size, or how would you characterize the church, and maybe tell us, it'd be helpful, how you would characterize your preaching style. I mean, do you preach with notes, do you preach without notes, do you use overheads, is it more of a teaching style, or... maybe you don't have any style. Ben, why don't we start with you?
All right. Well, I've been a missionary with the Navigators for 20 years. I just got back from Australia, and now I'm a full-time pastor of the Main Baptist Church and associate staff of the Navigators. Just started pastoring this church September 1st, and man, I'm using notes, I'm using things, I can't believe I got Sunday morning messages, an adult Sunday school class, I got Sunday evening message, I've had Wednesday evening, I've altered that a little bit, but I get great blessings out of the Bible, but knowing how to put them together, come up with the goods to deliver them to people, time after time after time, I just that's where I am, and I'm encouraged. We've got about 200 people there on Sunday morning, and some now and then I've seen in the last few weeks it's grown. I think the word's getting out there, at least people can get fed here, you know, that we're talking about the Lord and work. And we've got 27 going, and they're encouraged about it.
How long did you say you've been there, Ben?
September 1st.
So you just started?
I just started being a pastor. I'm not even ordained yet. They're going to work that out hopefully by Christmas.
Now, do you have seminary training background?
Mine's been, I graduated from Indiana University. I was going to dental school. So
that's been basically experience. Oh, you sound like you're so busy. No wonder you came to this retreat to get some rest here. Good.
I've scheduled to keep in about a 200 person church to do everything that's out. I'm in a North American Baptist church in Dickinson, North Dakota. Average attendance about 180. On Sunday morning, with ministry numbers about 250, 255. I am a second career. I spent 10 years in retail management. I opened the Citadel in Florsheim shoes here, and spent 3 years at Kenny Shoe Corporation. He's the general manager for Off Street Burger Show here in town when they were still running. Then was transferred off to the Front Range, ended up in Salt Lake City, and ended up losing a job. Baptist preacher's kid, who spent most of my years running, saying, not me. So here I am, 36, and now pastor of a church. Went back to college in 78. And have a degree in music, and I'm a seminary.
Which seminary? Sioux Falls? How long have you been at this church?
2.5 years.
Two and a half.
I came on as associate staff for youth and family ministry. one half of our church, about 260, 122, are the age of 22.
Huh.
Real young church.
Yeah. And this is American Baptist.
North American
North
Baptist.
American.
The old German Baptist.
And has yours been an independent Baptist church? Independent Baptist.
Ben has passed to go through burnout and midlife. Now I'm passing by myself in this church for the last 7 months.
Mm-hmm. So you went there to be, there was another pastor when you went?
I was on staff and then.
Yeah.
Mark Bryan from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area. He's been there about 3 years at the Presbyterian Church USA and came to Gordon Conwell Seminary back in the middle 70s, about 70, 78, and youth pastor, assistant pastor really, but primarily dealing with youth. And served two churches out in the country, which is where I started preaching. And really was not very good, quite frankly. Not filling out.
You're the first one that I've met that ever admitted that.
Yeah, that's really true. I think I've improved a lot, and I've not had anything in seminar or challenge to improve or new ideas or whatever for about 4 years, not even more.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured, you know, it's about time I better do something. While I feel like I'm still improving, I'm still also keenly aware of it. So far to go. And I guess I'm really surprised that there aren't more here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I figured, gee, this thing's going to fill up. And, you know, but I was, you know, I guess it's just what you said.
Well, it's also the nature of this conference, too. I think if you go to different kind of conferences, there's much more emphasis put on preaching skills. We're here. On the whole process of discipling is more the emphasis.
I found the reason I'm in here is the simple fact I found I like to preach and have a hard time spending the 40% of my time I should be preparing a sermon.
Right.
I preach from an outline.
Right.
And I enjoy just, I run, I outline it, then I manuscript it, and then I outline it again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I found that it's the only time I meet with most of my people is that Sunday morning experience.
Right.
And if I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah, see, this is the problem I think a lot of people don't understand. The emphasis is not made here, which I think should be more than it is, that the primary place that the pastor could disciple people is on Sunday morning in the pulpit and preaching. And if you can't do the job there, you're not going to have time to do it one-on-one, no matter how, no matter what the size of the church is. I mean, you what, 200 members, you said, and yours about 200, and mine's 5,000, but it doesn't make any difference. You can't disciple 200 people any more than I can disciple 5,000. I mean, it's impossible. Or 150. I mean, one-on-one. But the biggest impact we have is on that Sunday morning in that pulpit, and that's why preaching is terribly important.
I preach... I call it notes, but it's probably really a manuscript, but I just outline it rather than doing it paragraph by paragraph. I break it down like an outline on the full sentence. And I guess my style is totally more conversational. I'm not a very formal person. Sometimes I like to do first person sermons and take the role of someone else and that kind of thing to break it up. And I've done conversations with God. In a kind of prayer format. First time I did, I asked the people to know whether to keep their heads bowed or
looking up. Now, what did you say the size of the church is?
Our average attendance around 120.
Around
120. Around
200. Good. Jack.
I'm kind of in Ben's position somewhat. I wasn't missing in the field or anything, but I've just been called to be assistant pastor at the church in Blythe, American Baptist Church there. 7 months ago, full-time on staff as of 7 months ago. I work a lot with the youth, but I'm also in charge of the discipleship and evangelism program at the church, which takes up most of my time. But I know in the near future, I'm going to be called to do some of the Sunday morning ministry there at the church, instead of what's now a youth. They do most of the Sunday evenings in the Sunday school for our young adults. We have about 250 members and about our average attendance is 170. But as far as just is walking up there and a week long preparing a sermon type thing. The Sunday night is more just a teaching, instructional type thing.
And you do Sunday nights?
But I've never had the opportunity, or I don't really feel that I don't have any seminary background that I'm that well prepared to step up to the pulpit and just, you know, preach a sermon, or even to have the real knowledge that God's given me to put it down into.
Is your background Bible college? Or?
Yeah, I've taken some classes at Wheaton College.
Wheaton. Oh, good. Good.
But I'm just looking for some good ideas tried and tested ideas.
Now, are you ordained in the Baptist Church?
I'm kind of.
You are. You're going to be. You are, of course. Yeah. Great. Dave, how about you?
Well, I want to put Jack at ease. One of the first questions George asked somebody, or sometimes, is what school you went to. And I graduated a year ago in May from Western in Portland, Oregon. And so still in the habit of saying, oh, where do you go to school? Because that's the thing. And I've known many men in Southern ministries who are men who have not gone, quote unquote, to seminary or college, and have godly men and walk with the Lord. And I've learned as much from them than so-called theologians. And I think Dr. Langley in perspective today, those, you know, with all these big degrees and everything, teach certain truths that are not right. So an education is known as a mark. Mm. God's man. So I apologize when I said that to you at first, or asked you that, and realized that, because I have a man in my church who keeps me humble, and he talked about his paid ministers. And I always assured Roy, I said, well, you know, I didn't come into this ministry for the pay. I said, my goal is whether God called me to be a tent maker or not, I'd be in the ministry. Right. He's called me to minister first and foremost. So I can say that our church doesn't have official membership. They've always voted it down, I guess, in the past. But if we were to say how many people would call our church home, it'd be over 100 or so. But our average attendance is now around 80 or so on a Sunday morning. It's a community church, basically, Baptistic donuts in a full age. It's decidedly so. Read this doctrinal statement there. You thought somebody from Dallas or Western had written it's dispensational, all those things. So, gives you an idea we're working on, but
we won't hold it.
Okay. Well, too much for my dispensational friends, not enough for my Reformed friends. I'm sort of like Steve Jackson, kind of down the middle.
In the middle.
Stuff. But anyway, having been at Western, Jim Andrews was one of our homiletics pastors, and who taught at Western. There in Denver, Western Bible College. And so our experience has been a real strong expository, stating your theme or your main point or whatever you want to call it, and then defending it. And we were just real rigid, real logical, developing and bringing the people along type of an approach. And deacons took me aside this last winter and said, you have to be a little more obvious with this. Don't just, you know, state your point and then defend it. He said, you know, it's logical and everything, but we need to say you're interrogative, because the one is a graduate of Fuller, pastor for a number of years. And he said, I know what you're doing. He said, these folks don't. And so I've been at tension with what I was taught. This is how you preach. And to be in a situation where, and I should have known that, because I was a communications major in college, to realize that I should have known my audience better. To realize that it's nice to be formal and do everything. Mr. Andy said, this is how you have to do it. And to realize that it was biblical truth, it was good preaching, but it was not ministering to needs of people because it was. I can look at their notes and they get the point, but it's like, so what? How does this apply?
How does it relate?
And rather than what you were saying, Martin, I read that book by Lewis, by both Lewis and Simon. Inductive preaching. I've tried that. And basically the same type of formula, expository, taking a passage or a paragraph or a topic, whatever it might be, developing it, but asking those questions, more role playing, doing those other things. You used to do this and then that. Kind of like what we're doing now. And to see the people that watch the lights come on. And now to hear comments and people are being fed that, well, the ability hasn't changed, but the method has. And yet I struggle with what I was taught, but this is preaching. And so I came today because anytime I can learn more about preaching, the synopsis on you excited me. I thought, oh, and this guy got it. He must know something. Things are going well. And to learn from other pastors what is working for them and how I can be a better communicator, I guess I've resigned myself to the fact that I want to be God's communicator. And if there's anything saying good or great, or we'll let him take care of that. But I want to be God's communicator.
How long did you say you've been there, Dave?
Been there about a year and a half.
Year and a half.
A year this last month.
Yeah. So all of you are fairly new in the places where you've been. Yeah. Well, you know, you've raised some real interesting things maybe we could talk about for a little bit. One of the problems with preaching, maybe problem is the wrong word, one of the difficulties in having a seminar or a discussion like this is that we're not all agreed, not everyone is in agreement, as to what preaching is. That's the first problem we have. I mean, maybe we agree on what it isn't, yeah, better, but we have a hard time agreeing on what it is. I mean, the Bible says that Jesus came preaching and teaching. Seeming to imply that there is a difference. And yet, when I hear a lot of people talk about preaching, and when I hear about some of the preaching going on in a lot of churches, I wonder if there is a difference. In the minds of a lot of, quote, preachers. At a conference like this, you tend to run into a lot of people who, from the tradition that I'm coming from and the background and training that I've had, are teaching in the pulpit on Sunday morning and not preaching. A lot of people from the general milieu that's represented at this conference would say that the people in my tradition and in my orientation are giving talks, but not preaching. And so we have a problem trying to get at in talking about preaching what it is. What's going on? What you know, you use the word expository, and in certain areas of the church's life, anything that isn't expository is not preaching. Great scorn cast in some area, I'm not saying you do this, but some great scorn cast on topical preachers. And believing that that's not what preaching is. I come from a tradition that says expository preaching is more teaching and not preaching. And so we have this problem. And I don't know that it's a big deal that we've got to settle this, but it does influence the way you come at the task. If you see it primarily as a teaching medium, then you're going to prepare your sermons, you're going to structure your sermons, you're going to present your sermons in a kind of a pedagogical manner. Some preachers I know, not a lot, but some, One very famous preacher in this town, Mike Tucker, he's not here anymore, he's in Phoenix, but he's quite well known in the conservative Baptist circles, actually uses an overhead on Sunday morning and diagrams things. Well, in my world, when I'm talking about Presbyterian Church, I mean, this is absolutely, I mean, that is, you know, a total no-no to do that, because that should be saved for the classroom, we believe. But I mean, in his tradition, his understanding of what he's doing, this is very good. He uses an overhead, he diagrams, he is actually teaching on Sunday morning. So he structures things that way. If you see preaching something other than teaching, now I don't mean that it doesn't have a teaching dimension to it maybe, but not primarily a teaching mode, you'll come at it differently, and you will ask some of these questions like you asked. What are the needs out here? And how does Scripture relate to those needs? You see, I believe that what preaching should be is biblical. That's what it should be. Not necessarily expository, but biblical. What do the Scriptures say to us in the context of our lives? And what I'm wanting to do on Sunday morning is to try to link up the biblical witness to the needs that are represented in the people out there and where people are. And sometimes you can do that in a kind of a verse-by-verse, word-by-word exposition, but not always. And sometimes a topical approach is a good way to do it. There's nothing, in my view, now I'm just giving you my biases here. I think all the scorn that's heaped on topical preaching is misplaced and has led a lot of expounders of the word astray. There's nothing wrong with a topical approach as long as it is biblical. In fact, it may be the very right approach for a particular situation, a particular need that people have. So I'm a big exponent of biblical preaching, and I think that's what we need to be about. I am not big on teaching in the pulpit, although I believe that every good sermon has a teaching element to it. But I believe that when we start using the pulpit for teaching primarily, we tend to create the kind of preaching that gives a lot of answers to questions people aren't asking and sets up a lot of doctrinal stuff, but doesn't address the heart and the spiritual issues that are in people's lives. I mean, you can be imparting an awful lot of information. That's all very good and wonderful, but it's not inspirational. A lot of evangelical conservative preaching is instructional, but it isn't motivational. It doesn't move anybody. People walk out and say, "Pastor, that was wonderful. I understand now the doctrine of justification by faith." You know. But so what? You know, I mean, understanding it, is that going to change your life? I mean, are you going to... It would be much better to have people at the door say to you, not "I understand," but it would be much better to have them say what Isaiah said: "Woe is me, I'm undone." You know, he was in an act of worship in Isaiah 6 there, brought into the presence of God in such a way that he was overpowered, overwhelmed by what he encountered, by what he heard and experienced, and was motivated to change his life. The message he heard that day was, "Who will go for me?" It was a challenge. It was overwhelming. And Isaiah responded, "Here I am, Lord, send me." Now, people can hear all the right information on Sunday morning and not be moved in any way whatsoever. And our job as preachers is to move those people. It is not to stuff their head with a lot of information. It is to address their lives in a way that is so challenging that it absolutely moves them. They cannot help but respond with their life. Now, don't get me wrong. There is a time for instruction. The only point I'm trying to make in all this is that's not what we're doing when we're preaching. I make a big distinction. I believe that the Scriptures means what it says when it tells us that Jesus came preaching and teaching. Basically, the Sermon on the Mount is teaching. We maybe have mistitled that a little bit. Jesus didn't call it the Sermon on the Mount. I'm not sure exactly who did, but somebody did, and that's okay. But basically what we have there is his teachings. He sat down on the mountain. And when everybody, in Jesus' day, when everyone in a position of like a rabbi or a teacher, whenever he sat down, that was going to be instructional. When he stood up, it's going to be proclamational. Different. When you hear the parable, you've got preaching going on, not instruction. I mean, when you hear the story of the prodigal son, and you read the story of the prodigal son, you cannot read that properly, I don't think, without being moved by it. I mean, it's a very moving story. He is preaching. He is not giving an expository presentation on the law or the Old Testament or anything. He is talking topically about the love of God, the love of the Father. It's a topical sermon, and it is incredibly moving. And it touches every one of us when we hear it in a way that the Sermon on the Mount does not. The Sermon on the Mount stimulates our thinking. You have heard it said, but I say to you, this is the way the Old Testament, this is the way that Judaism has depicted spiritual, godly truths. This is what I say to you. And always it was a challenge to the way things were normally thought to be. And he presented a new way. But I think you've got teaching going on there. In the parables, you've got preaching. Now look at the parables. I think if you really want to know how to preach, look at the parables. What were they? They were stories. They were pictures. Jesus painted pictures. He told stories. He put people into the context of these stories so they could see themselves there in the midst of that story. That is great preaching when you can do that.
Put people into it.
Put people into it. So everybody's sitting out there saying, "That's me. That's where I'm at. That's where I've been. That's where I'm going." That's the struggle that I'm facing right now. That's the issue that I'm wrestling with. That's what you want to do. Now, I would submit to you that that is incredibly difficult to do. It is easier to teach, much easier to teach, much easier. It is much easier to do expository preaching, much easier. Listen, without spending 1 hour of preparation, I can open my Bible and start a passage and go through it verse for verse. I don't need any preparation. And I can go on for hours and hours. I mean, anybody who is biblically astute can do that. I mean, this is why I love teaching things, because I don't need to prepare that much. I'm telling you a little something, I hate to kind of admit this, but, you know, I can just move through the thing and just go, and I can go on for hours. And, you know, most of your, and again, I don't want to attack them, please try to understand me, but a lot of your great Baptist preachers on Sunday night, people wonder, how in the world can they preach in the morning and preach at night? Not hard to preach at night. They just open the Bible and start talking, and if they're good with gab, and most of them are, they can talk for 45 minutes and it's no big problem, just moving through it. And I don't mean what they're saying isn't helpful. It is. Most of these people are tremendous. I don't know if you've ever heard Charles Stanley down at First Baptist in Atlanta, who was the president of the Southern Baptist Convention. I mean, he could go on, literally. He could preach every single night and go on and on. He knows the Bible so well, and he can bring up so many interesting things. But he doesn't need to prepare a minute for that kind of preaching, that kind of work. I know he doesn't, because he is so steeped in the Word that just flows for him. And I'm not saying what he is doing isn't valuable and helpful. It is, and I think Sunday night maybe is a place for a kind of preaching that is more teaching. But to do what I'm talking about on a Sunday morning, to engage people and have them see themselves in that picture that you're painting there, that takes a tremendous amount of work, is extremely difficult, and is very, very, very hard to do, and very, very few preachers do it. Only a few. And that's why so much, I believe, preaching today is so dull and so boring and so unrelated to where people are, because we don't have preachers, by and large, who are willing to put in that kind of work to do that. It is much easier to do the other. And with all the calling everybody has to do, and all the committees they have to go to, and all the youth groups they have to lead and everything, preaching usually, the more active the church gets, the more it flourishes, the less and less time is spent on preaching. And the more you're around, the less time you need to devote time to preaching if you do this other kind of preaching. So you move more and more towards this other kind of preaching, and the result is that your preaching becomes more and more irrelevant. That doesn't mean that there won't be people there on Sunday morning. There will. Because what happens in the church is that they get to know and love you as a person. And so they will excuse your incompetence and ineffectiveness on Sunday morning. Because you are a great guy, and you have been there when they needed you, and you come to the hospital when people are sick, and you bury and you bury, and you are a terrific guy, so they can endure 30, 35 minutes of you on Sunday morning, essentially doing something that doesn't touch them at all. But they will accept you in the process. I think if a church wants to have a pulpit ministry that reaches out, though, into the community, and really engages people, a different kind of preaching has to be done.
Who would you label as that, do you know, right now, nationally?
Me?
Well, we don't
hear
you.
No, I'm trying to do it. Very few. Very few. Because the trouble is, by and large, we are focusing our preaching primarily on a small little in-group. It's already in the church. We're not trying to get beyond that group into the community. See, on Sunday morning, I think we have to have three focus. This is also what makes preaching extremely difficult. You talk about got to know these people and who they are. That's very important. Very important. You need to analyze who are these people that you're preaching to on Sunday morning. And that, but you've got to ask another question. Not only who are the people that you're preaching to, but who are the people you want to preach to? Not just who are you preaching to, but who do you want to preach to? Yeah. See, on Sunday morning, I want to preach to some people that beyond the loyalists, beyond the regulars, beyond the ones who are always there, I want to reach, if I can, that person who God only knows why is there, who just came in, and I maybe have got, from a preacher point of view, and I'm not putting the whole burden on me, but I'm talking at it from a preacher point of view, I've maybe only got this one Sunday to get to him. He may not be back. I don't know why he came. I haven't got the faintest clue. I look out, and there he is. I've never seen him before in church. I may know him from the community. I don't know why he's there. He may have had a fight with his wife the night before, and she told him he needs God or something, so he came in the morning, or I don't know why he's there. But he's there, and this is my one shot with him, maybe. Maybe not, but maybe so. And I want to address him. He's not a church person, you know. The other side of the coin, though, I've got Harry Jones down here, who has come to the church the whole 17 years that I've been preaching. He's there every Sunday. He never misses, unless he's out fishing or hunting or something. He's always there, and he's heard every, you know, sermon that's been preached in the church, 5,000 of them. And I know that he's very hard to reach. He's hard to move because he's heard it all. You start out on a sermon, take this sermon of the prodigal son. Suppose you start to preach on it. You know, the easiest sermons to preach are on obscure texts. You know, someone says, that's interesting. That was interesting. I never heard a sermon preached on that text. You know, don't take that as a compliment. Anybody can preach on an obscure text. Take the biggies. Take the prodigal son. Take the good Samaritan. Take the ones that your people have heard 10,000 sermons on. And that's where you've got a real challenge. And those are the texts that separate the people who are really good and the people who are. Make the prodigal son relate to people who have heard 500 sermons on it. If you can do that, you have done a great job. But I'll tell you something, in my view, it takes an incredible amount of work to make the sermon on the prodigal son relate to this guy who's been listening for 17 years to you preach. That is very, very, very tight. So you want to reach him and you want to reach them, the guy who just came in. And then you've got a middle group that you want to reach to that are there sometimes but not all of them. And their commitment is what I call fringe commitment. They're not really steeped in the Word. They're not really committed to the Lord, but they're intrigued by it. They're interested in it. If anyone asked them, they would say, yes, I'm a Christian and I belong to the church. And so, but they really are not people who have really been touched. And so you're trying to move at three levels here, at least. Now, within that, you've got all kinds of other differences. You've got youth. You've got the high school kid, you've got the college kid, you've got the single person, you've got the widowed person, you've got, you know, all these variations within those three groupings, but those are the three groupings. Now, a teaching approach, I don't think, reaches those people. Basically, the teaching approach tends more to speak to this guy, maybe. Maybe somewhere along you intrigue the person in the middle, but very out there, very hard. I just came back from being in, I just got in this morning from Atlanta, but last night I had a very interesting experience with a group of ministers, and it was being pointed out that studies are showing that Gallup and others are, you know, George Gallup is a Christian and very interested in studying the church and people's response to Christianity and so forth. And runs survey. I don't know if you know, he actually has a monthly survey that he does just on Christianity that you can subscribe to. But their studies are showing that 20 years ago, we had a population in which about 10% of the population did not speak or understand a biblical language. Now let me explain what he means by that. Approximately 10% of the population 20 years ago didn't know enough about the Bible, did not know enough about Scripture, did not know enough about things to be able to relate and understand a presentation that assumes some knowledge of Scripture. Like, I'm talking about the prodigal son or the good Samaritan, and I'm assuming that we all know the story. That's biblical language, see. I don't have to tell you the story, you know it. 10% 20 years ago. The statistic now is it's about 37% in 20 years. They don't know it. If you sat down and start talking about the Good Samaritan, they would not know what you're talking about. They do not know the story. If you got into the story of the Exodus, or you got into the story of an Old Testament story like Saul, David, I'm getting ready to preach on Saul this week, you can't assume that this guy who walked in to the service knows that story and understand what it's about. More and more people do not have a religious language. And this creates a tremendous problem for us, because in a lot of our church, you listen to a lot of biblical, you listen to a lot of these religious Christian speakers on the radio. I don't know if you ever do that. It's a pretty depressing experience, actually, to listen to them. But who in the world outside of church, people would listen to these broadcasts? And half the time, you realize that he's talking about things that people that are not in the church and in the Scripture don't have the faintest clue what he's talking about, and could care less if they did. Going back, this refers to Leviticus 18:42, and this is, you know, and that relates to this, and this relates to that, and all this shuffling of pages back and forth in the Bible. And, you know, people out there are saying, what in the world is he talking about? I'm very much opposed to turning pages and everything during sermons. I believe in eye contact. Communication. You're a communication major. If I'm preaching, I want to look you in the eye. I want to talk to you. And I don't want you writing. I don't like it when people take notes. If I'm doing... it's okay now, but if I'm doing my job of engaging people, see, getting caught up in the... I believe that when Jesus told the story of the prodigal son, people were so gripped by it. If they were taking notes, they stopped. Started listening. This is too important. I want to see your eyes, and I want to look you in the eye, and I want to grab you if I can. I don't want you flipping around in the Bible, and I don't want you writing. That'll come later when we go downstairs and have our class. But now I want to talk to you. I want to be like a father to a kid, and I say, now listen, son, I'm going to tell you this. This is important. You see? There's not enough of that in our preaching today. When people come up to me and say, you were talking right to me today, that is the, I tell you, I just, inside I say, oh, praise the Lord, that is exactly what I wanted to do. I hope, Lord, he means it. And not just saying that to make me feel good. That's what I'm trying to do. And I hope that I'm talking to you so intensely and so personally that you can't take notes. You don't have time to look anything up. This is too intense. You know, I was on the plane today, coming back. I just landed a few minutes ago. And, you know, I think a lot of Sunday mornings are like those first few minutes before the takeoff on the plane. The steward is telling us what we need to know to save our life. And no one is listening. Everyone's reading U.S. Today and talking even, you know. And no one's paying attention. She's saying, you know, if the plane goes down in water, this is your lifesaver. If, you know, if there's no oxygen, this is where you get air. She's telling us what we need to know to save ourselves, to be saved. And no one is paying attention to her. That's the way it is a lot of times, I think, on Sunday morning. We don't have eye contact. No one is looking up at the steward. He's showing you where the air comes down. He's showing you, you know, no one is paying any attention. They're going about their thing. They know it all. They've heard it 1,000 times. They don't need to listen to this. This is what goes on Sunday morning. Now, we've got very polite people in our church that walk, you know, they look up by and large, but they don't pay attention to what you're saying. You've got to get these people attention. I was very interested on the flight going out the other night, on a United flight. They actually are trying a different approach. And when the stewardess came on, she said, "Now listen up, folks. I'm going to tell you something that you may need to survive this flight." Boy, I started listening. I never heard anyone say it like that before, you know?
What do you know?
You're darn right, I'm going to listen to this. But you see the difference? I mean, I have been on 100 flights, and they always do this ritual, and you know, and you get where you don't pay attention. I've heard this. I don't need to know that. The way she said it, listen up, folks. I'm going to tell you something that may save your life on this flight. And all of a sudden, I looked up at her, and I started watching. And then I noticed, rather than just simply doing their little ritual, they were moving up and down the aisle and pointing and saying, "Look at this. Don't read your newspaper. Don't look there. Look at it. Look at me." That's what she was saying. "I'm telling you something. I want your attention." We need more of that on Sunday morning. It's very hard work to do that. It's hard to get people's attention in our churches. It's hard to get their attention the way we're structured up there in the pulpit behind the lectern with our papers and our books and the Bible and everything there. It's very hard to get people's attention. And yet that's what we have to do. We have to be engaging. We have to be gripping. We have to be moving. We have to be motivational. I'll tell you, to accomplish all that, I think it takes hours and hours and hours of preparation every week. I spend 20, 25 hours a week on my sermon. Then I spend another 5 hours every week preparing to preach it. Now there's a difference.
Well, what do you do in
25? I spend every morning working on sermon. Every morning, no matter what I'm doing. Today, even though I was on an airplane, I worked all the way out here. If I go somewhere to do something, I will still get up earlier in the morning if I need to get my time in, but I work every morning on sermons. I spend a lot of time studying, outlining, preparing the sequence that I'm going to. What I'm asking the questions when I come to a text is, how can I break this thing open for people? How can I get, like my sermon Sunday is entitled "Fighting Our Negative Emotions." And I'm dealing with the story of Saul. I told you I was talking about Saul. And how Saul, when he saw that God loved David, became very jealous. And I'm going to talk about this. negative. Now, the worst thing I could do, I think, would just get this story out and go verse by verse here. Now, the ninth chapter of 1 Samuel. What I want to do, we're going to read that passage, nine verses there. But I want to say, I want to try to get people into that story and say, you know, it's not just Saul's problem, this is our problem, this is my problem. Other people are getting blessed. Other people are prospering. Other people are healthy. Other people have got good marriages. Other people have got beautiful children. I have to admit sometimes that I feel envy or jealousy or even a little bit of anger with God. Why did you do this? You know, I'm a better person than this individual. Why am I? You know, they have this and I don't. So these negative emotions, trying to get people in there. So I'm trying to break this open for people. How can we fight those kinds of emotions? How can we not only fight them, but how can we defeat them? That's what I want to get. I've only got 23 minutes. I don't know how long you all preach, but in a Presbyterian church, you've had it 25. And I aim at 23, and I usually go 25. But I mean, 23 minutes? This is an incredibly short amount of time. You know, Dan Rather's got more time than I've got. How are we going to do this? So I struggle with this. And I try to outline. And I try. Then on Wednesdays, I start writing a manuscript. I believe in writing manuscripts. I think that you cannot preach effectively without writing a manuscript. Because when you start trying to write it down, you come very quickly to see whether you've got anything to say or not. Whether your thoughts are clear or whether they're just, you know, a lot of people think, well, I know what I want to say. Baloney. I never have bought that. People say to me, well, I know. I say, well, you got your sermon. No, but I know what I want to say. You don't know what you want to say till you start writing it down. Quite often you discover that what was kind of vaguely in the head, you can't get concretely down on the paper, which means you don't have it yet. You have to keep struggling. A lot of people are using word processors now. I think that's probably a pretty good idea if you're able to get beyond the techniques, mechanics of it, to be creative with it. I can't. I still write out on a yellow legal pad and reorganize that way, but a lot of people are using the word processor now. But I write a manuscript.
By that, you're writing out your message.
Absolutely. From first sentence to last sentence, I write it out. And then I usually, and let me show you how I do it, just on a piece of paper here. Well, I'll use this. I write on this side of the tablet, and I leave about 2 inches on this side blank. And then I go back on Thursday, and I will edit that thing using this blank side. I will maybe say, well, now here's, I could illustrate this with this point. I could use this as an illustration, or I could, maybe this paragraph's in the wrong place, and I'll draw an arrow and say, move it up here. That's where a word processor kind of helps. So I'll rewrite that manuscript sometimes. Sometimes I'll rewrite the whole thing again, taking and incorporating these things that are on the margin. And then on Friday, I will take that manuscript and I will turn that into what I call a paragraph outline. I start with an outline, but it's just a sentence outline. Now I'll turn it back into a paragraph outline with more basic thoughts here. Organizing the manuscript into an outline with the different paragraphs set out and the illustrations and so forth set out. And then that's what I spend about 20 hours to 25 hours doing every week, what I've just told you, from beginning to end to that point. Then, after I've done that, is when I begin what I call the preparing to preach, which is I spend Saturday night, I never go out on Saturday night, going over that paragraph outline. I never look at the manuscript again after I paragraphed outline. I never look at that again. But I go over this paragraph outline, try to get the gist of it, the message of it, the sequence of it in my mind, in my heart. Then I get up very early on Sunday morning. Our first service is 8 o'clock. I get up at 4 o'clock. And I work from 4 to 6. Again, going over all this. And I try to get it just really so that this message is in my life and in my heart. And then I put that paragraph outline on my desk and I go to church. I don't take it with me. I never look at it again. And then when I come to church, I'm ready to deliver a message. It's in my heart. I'm ready for the people. So I spend about 30 hours a week doing this. And it's, you know, many, many weeks, very difficult to get 30 hours in because I've got so many other things to do. But let's face it, you mentioned you've got 200 members, I forget the figures you used, but 170 people there on Sunday, something like that. Or you, maybe you said that, 170. There isn't anything during the week that gives you more contact and exposure with those people than that hour on Sunday morning. That's where the people are. I mean, and that's, you know, that's where the rubber meets the road there. So if we don't have it then, you know, we're really missing a tremendous opportunity and our chief calling. See, I disagree with the person who says paid preacher. I don't know this man, he's probably a wonderful guy, and I don't know what he meant by it, but you can't have a tent ministry and do what I do. And tent ministers don't have churches like I have either. I'm not bragging about my church, but I'm just simply saying, you know, to get almost 3,000 people to come out on a Sunday morning, you know, to have something to say to them, and to be studied and up and ready. I mean, this is some doing. You can't hold down another job and do this. It's impossible. And rather than, you know, we should, our people should say, I think, what Ben does on Sunday morning is so important and so meaningful to us that it would be criminal for him to spend his time working at a 7-Eleven or one of these other things. We want him to come on Sunday morning and lift us into the presence of God and reach out into this community and touch people in this community in a way that will really bring people into the presence of the Lord and really convict them and challenge them to commit their life to Christ. And we know that that takes a lot of work and it's a lot of skill. See, I think because we are usually so unprepared and so inept on Sunday morning, our people say, anybody could do that. No big deal. And when they've been around long enough, and particularly when we do this verse-by-verse thing, they say, you know, I could get up and talk for 40 minutes on these verses too. It's no big thing. So their view of us goes down, whether we know it or not, it does. And so they ask these questions, you know, they talk about paid preachers, you know, soft life. Get up for an hour on Sunday morning and talk, and the rest of the week you can do anything you want. Or I got to punch the clock every day, you know. Well, if we do our job right, I think the people sitting out there would say, you know, I can't do that. I can't do that. And it's not an easy thing that he's doing. And when that happens, our stock goes up. And I don't mean that in the sense that we are elevated or above people, but there is a sense of appreciation for what we do that creates a tremendous support system. People come in and say to you, I'm praying for you this week as you're preparing your sermon. When people say that, you know that they have caught a little glimpse of how hard it is to do what we're trying to do. And that we need prayer, and we need, it's impossible to do what we're doing without the prayer support of a lot of these. See, I want my people, and of course we don't achieve this, of course, but I want this guy who's there every Sunday for 17 years or whatever, knows the Bible front and back, maybe knows it better than I do, probably does. I want him, when he sees that guy walk in that isn't there every week, I want him to be praying that, Lord, help John to be able to get in touch with that guy today. I don't need it, I'm here, come hell or high water, but Lord, I never saw him before in this church, and Lord, help John this morning. That's what I want from him, see. And when you have that, and if that prayer is answered and the Holy Spirit comes, then we might have a chance of reaching. But the average person in the pew today, I don't think, because of the low caliber of preaching that's done in so many churches, he does not have a high view of what we're doing and how difficult it is to do. And so he doesn't have a high view of us. But when one sees that this is a very difficult thing that you're trying to do, and it takes a lot of work and is worth having you ordained for, and this is what I think ordination means, set apart for this ministry. And when he sees that that's worthwhile, then I think you get a different kind of feeling from your people and you get a different kind of support from them for what you're doing. And we need that support, because it's impossible to do this. It's impossible to preach as I think we need to preach without people praying for us and without the Holy Spirit at work within us. I mean, when you think about it, trying to reach all these different kinds of groups, trying to reach out people at all these different levels, I mean, apart from the Holy Spirit, this is an impossible task. And it takes a lot of time. I spend a lot of time in prayer. I said, I struggle with how can I break this thing open? And that's my prayer every week. Lord, help me to find a way to make this thing relate to these people in a way that matters. I don't want people to say to me, that was interesting. I don't want to be interested.
Right. But I'm sure you've got more resources than that.
I read constantly, yeah.
Yeah.
This is one of the great problems with ministers. They do not read. They do not read.
I think there's I was just going to comment on what Ben just said, which I'm wrong, is that I think a lot of us, there's more of an awareness about reading, but it's sort of like the Harvard shelf of books that you've been a graduate of Harvard.
Yeah.
All the classics. And then there's an index that tells you how to use this to read better. In other words, who to read first and then read next to relate all that. I think that's the thing Mr. Anders and so many have always said, read, but read what? Until he mentioned Alfred Bloom today, I'd not heard about that, but it sounds like something I should have read.
Uh-huh.
So what should we?
Well, you need to read very, very broadly and expose yourself very broadly. That's a very good question that you've raised, and it's a very important one. I think ministers probably will be, some people won't agree with this, but I think ministers ought to watch a lot of television. They ought to go to a lot of movies. They ought to read a lot of magazines. They ought to read the newspaper every day. They ought to watch the evening news every night. They ought to read a lot of novels, or the morning news or whatever. They ought to read a lot of novels. They should try very hard to stay conversant with the thought patterns of the society in which they live and the people that they are trying to relate to. This is where a lot of, I think, of us get off track. We buy all our books in the Christian bookstore. the last place we ought to be.
I took a two-day preaching class with Joel Gregory, who was the preaching professor at Southwestern.
Mm-hmm.
And he said the exact thing he did about reading. Mm-hmm. He said, this is how I do it.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you don't have to get these magazines. He usually goes to a library on the university or your city, uses the periodical index, and goes in and reads articles on the topics he's preaching on, or just sit down for a couple hours a week in a library.
Uh-huh.
And there are resources.
Right.
Except for one that we ignore constantly. And almost every town has a library with magazines.
Well, or I'll tell you another thing you can do. Use some people in your congregation to help you out. Pick out someone, or someone maybe that you admire or respect, someone you think is a thoughtful person. Maybe an ex-school teacher, retired school teacher, or just somebody that you know is an intelligent person. Ask them if they subscribe to any magazines or anything, or maybe they get the Wall Street Journal or the Christian Science Monitor or something like this. Ask them to read for you. And if they find anything that they think would be of interest to you or helpful to you in understanding what's going on in the world or how people are thinking today, to tear it out and give it to you. So that rather than you having to read the whole magazine, you might just read a page and they might mark a paragraph or something. When I was in seminary, I had a roommate who was going with, at that time, Bobby Kennedy was the Attorney General, and John Kennedy was President. His brother was the Attorney General. And my roommate was going with Bobby Kennedy's, with one of his assistants. And her job was just to read magazines and newspapers and clip things out, and then she would put them in a notebook. She did this every day, and he would get this notebook when he arrived, when the car picked him up at the house in the morning. He'd get this notebook, and he would read these clippings. He'd read these marked paragraphs in this notebook on the way to the office. If he had a luncheon, on the way to the lunch, he'd read them. If he was flying somewhere, he'd read them. Every minute he had, he was reading these things. The next day, she'd have another one ready for him. And that, I think, is... Well, we obviously can't have anybody like that. It would be nice to have somebody like that on our staff. But we've got people in our church that are retired. People who do subscribe to all these, some of these magazines. Not all of them, but... And they could read for us and clip things for us. I think there's a tremendous research resource out there that we really have not tapped. You've got to tell people what you're looking for, too. Like I have had people, I don't have one right now, but I've had people, and I've said to them, I want you to find, if you come across anything that's what you would call a human interest story, I'd like to have it. I'd like to see it. So look for those things. Or I'll say to someone else, I'm interested in things that relate to ethics, to morals, breakdown of morals. If you find anything in that category in your reading, clip it out, let me have it. Get people working for you like that. That's one way you can do it. But you still got to, you know, it still takes time to read even these things, you know. But you need to do that. I read, like, the New York Times every week, book review. I think this is very important. I get the New York Times Sunday issue, and I read see the book review. And if I see a book, a novel or something that they seem to think is a very important one, it's going to be significant, I'll at least read the review. I may not have time to read the book, but I'll read the review. If I think from reading the review that it's really a pretty significant book, I'll go out and buy it. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with Percy Walker. Well, a lot of people think Percy Walker is one of the best novelists of our time. And his most recent novel is The Thanatos Syndrome. And the featured review on the front page of the New York Times the week that it came out. It was obvious that this was going to be a very, very big novel, as far as they were concerned. and dealing with an important theme. So I went out and bought the novel, and I read that. It's important, I think, to read fiction. Movies, like right now, I haven't seen it yet, but this morning I read, I've decided I'm going to go see this movie, Fatal Attraction. Some of you, have you seen it?
No, my wife and I aren't going to see it. Uh-huh.
Well, Time Magazine today, the issue that came out today is on the whole women's movement and their hostility towards men. The Shara Height has come out with a new book on women, and in it they point out that the hostility between men and women that exists in our society today is the central theme in this movie, Fatal Attraction. Well, we have a luncheon at our church twice a month for working women. It's an outreach luncheon. We try to get the women in our church who work to invite their friends and associates at work to come to this luncheon. And I'm going to be talking at this luncheon. And one of the things I'm going to talk about is the tremendous, in the first one I'm going to do, is the tremendous anger that a lot of women have today. Not always confessed, but their life is tough. They've got to work now. The family can't make it without them working. They still got to keep the home going, still got to be a mother to the children, and they got to cook the dinner at night. And it's just a lot of women that are chafing at this. And we talk a little bit about this. And it's coming out of the whole story of Mary and Martha, which is really what I'm going to talk about. But I don't know if I'll bring this up, but this is a possibility, a possible angle to work on. So I want to see this movie, and I was reading this article today. But this is the kind of thing I think we have to constantly be searching for these vehicles that will get us into where people are and get them into the picture and what we're trying to talk about. And it takes a lot of work to do that.
She's
not going to have him come and use her and leave. She's going to get him. And there's a lot of women, today that are very, very hostile to what men have done in their life, to them, usually their husband. And they may not go after him like this gal apparently goes after this man, but, buddy, you will pay. There's a lot of attitude that's there. A lot of it in our churches. We kid ourselves and we think it isn't there. A lot of women think they've not, this guy's not done me right. So, it's a possible way of getting into it. I don't know. Maybe after I see the movie, I'll say it isn't. But I think there isn't anything I want to use. But that's what I mean, staying exposed. Now, a lot of ministers will say, oh, God, there's the sex scenes in that. I don't want anything to do with that movie. I think we got to think a little differently. I mean, this is where our people are. I'm not going to advocate this movie. But I think it, last week it was the biggest box office draw in the country. And I don't know how many people in my congregation saw it. Probably not a lot, but who knows. But it's a lot of people have seen it, and I want to stay in touch with that. Just like I met a minister last year, I can't remember where it was, who had never seen the Bill Cosby show. He was very proud. He said, I never watched television. That sounds wonderful. It sounds spiritual. And they probably do watch too much television. But the Bill Cosby show is watched by more people in this country than anybody else, any other program. It's the number one program. I don't want to watch it every week. I only watch it maybe three or four times a season. But you definitely ought to know about the show. You ought to know something. I mean, how can you live in America and not? But the same is true of Dallas and and Dynasty and these others too. See, we think Bill Cosby's okay because that's a wonderful, clean family show. The reason I watch it, not because it's a great show, because I personally don't like it. I don't find it myself that engaging, but I want to know what it's about because I know so many people want to watch it. Same as I want to know, they're kind of old hat now, but when Dynasty was doing so well a couple of seasons ago, I watched it for about 6 weeks in a row just to get some sense of who these characters were and how they related to one another. And I think it's important to get that, see that. So you need to, I get Fortune magazine, I get Time magazine, I get Newsweek magazine, I get Atlantic magazine, I get Harper's magazine, I get, I subscribe to about 20 magazines myself. My wife does a lot of work and she will look through magazines and she will mark them for me. And I tear magazines up. I'll tear a page out. Like on the plane today, I tear things out. I tear things out. And I will maybe put a heading on it. If it has to do with youth or something, I might put youth up there or something. And then I throw them in a box and don't try to file them or anything. But I have a pretty good memory and usually can find them if I need them. But reading is very important. Going to a lot of meetings and things. I mean, I don't just go to church meetings. I go to things in the community. I do a lot of invocating more than I like at conventions and things. I listen to talks, speakers there. You can learn a lot by hearing by seeing what kind of people the insurance people have or the bankers have. All the bankers in Colorado have a big meeting every year here at the Broadmoor, about 500 of the presidents and vice presidents and things of banks, and you can tell a lot by the people they pay $10,000 to come and talk to them about what they think's important and interesting in this world. And it's that banker that I want to relate to too. He may be one of those guys that shows up Sunday morning. I look out there and my gosh, there's the president of First National Bank. I've never seen him in my church before. And I want to know where I can make touch with him.
You don't make your shift then.
Oh, no. Yeah, always I'm trying to work on these three levels every Sunday. That this has got to be a sermon that's got to relate at three different places. I mean, this weekend I was, yesterday I was in Atlanta, as I told you, one of the ministers there was Robert Schuller. And of course, you know, a lot of controversy about him, and I'm not the biggest fan of Schuller in the world, but I do think Schuller's got some things to say to us that's pretty important, and that is that, you know, too many of us are talking to the same people all the time. And somehow or another, if our churches are going to grow, and if they're really going to be evangelistic churches, we've got to get beyond the people who are already in the flock to the ones who are not. And while Sunday morning should address the people of the church that are there, it should also, though, address the people who hopefully your membership have brought on Sunday morning too. So it's got to have several levels that it's going at, and that's tough, very, very, very tough to do.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what you're saying seemed like the format we were primarily taught was a proposition. You state your proposition, and you basically defend it by saying, you know, how to get to the end. I think the proposition one student put up that time was how to get to the end. The clean record.
Mm-hmm.
His point, his first 2 points I can remember, one was making sexual purity a priority in your life.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what the second one is, but that seems what a lot of the preaching,
I guess the background I came from was it was being taught to do that. Mm-hmm. And in the circles or in the conservative Baptist churches out there, now Mr. Andrews is probably one of the best communicators I've ever heard. Mm-hmm. With illustrations, mm-hmm. he was mm-hmm. well-read, mm-hmm. all these other mm-hmm. things. And he can move people. He just being class when mm-hmm. he teaches.
Sure, he's great. I know that.
But what I found is a problem, and I guess that's what I've... there's a side of a point maybe, but... is to do that in class or in that specific type of the church, mm-hmm. 300, 400, 500, like hence the 1600 members or something, and say, you know, make your proposition and
right.
logically, clearly from the text, prove it, you know, like Stuart Briscoe did last night,
mm-hmm.
challenging.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure, sure.
Things. And to do that and think, well, I'm doing that well, and then to have your deacons tell you that's not what we need. Kind of just blows you out of the saddle because mm-hmm. one, the comment wasn't it's not good preaching, it's just not where we're at. And is what you're trying to say then you can use that if that ministers, but use something as long as it's biblical that is going to grab their thing, grab yeah. out of you, and you can look at it and have that eyeball.
Well, see, I think there's a place for that, and I think, you see, the trouble we have in most of our churches is that the adult education program is a bust. I mean, we've got 15 people in the kitchen having coffee. That's the adult Bible class. If we really had adult education going in our churches, you would be able to do that in a teaching setting with our people and give them the doctrinal teachings that they need, the underpinnings of faith. But since we don't have that, and we only have them on Sunday morning in the worship service, we tend to turn the worship service into a classroom setting, and we do this teaching there because it's the right time. But see, I have a real problem. I know he's great, and I know this, I'm sure much, much more thoughtful on this matter than I am, but I have a real problem with this stating your proposition and then bringing to bear all these biblical verses to prove it. I think that is a way of preaching that just doesn't relate to these people who are a growing segment that are religiously illiterate or do not have a biblical language. You have to... So I am increasingly beginning to see preaching as being to... needing to be more in a seeing more as a storytelling or as drama. I don't want to carry that too far because I don't totally mean what I'm saying, but there's got to be more surprise to it. It can't be presented. The gospel cannot be presented. Preaching cannot be done in a lawyer-like fashion. That's my problem with that. It's too much like we're presenting a brief before judges to make a statement and then say, now I can support what I'm saying biblically because it says this in John and it says this in Galatians and it says this. And these people out there, except for your people who are just absolutely, you know, into this thing, they're just not tuned to that. These are people who watch the Bill Cosby show. Don't forget that. And what is the Bill Cosby show? It's a surprise. They set up a dilemma. And then, at the very end, the dilemma is resolved in an engaging, surprising kind of way, usually. Fatal Attraction is a surprise movie because nobody really knows what's going to happen at the end. It holds your attention, apparently. Tremendous surprise ending. Good preaching kind of that way. I mean, rather than say, set up your proposition and then prove it, set up the situation that engages everybody and everybody says, yeah, that's me. Then you move them to some kind of a creative biblical resolution of that problem or that tension that's set up in the beginning. Like this week is talking about Saul. We all have this problem. whether we want to admit it or not, of these things that are ugly that happen in us when we see other people moving ahead or getting ahead or having things we don't have, and these negative emotions that are in us, and they can cause a lot of trouble. In fact, you look at Saul, they caused a tremendous amount of trouble, and he ended up committing suicide at the end. They got so much the better of him, destroyed him. I want to set up, you know, these emotions and then bring down, how could Saul have ended up differently than he did? See, how could the story have ended differently? It's too late for Saul, but it isn't too late for you. How can your story end different? That's what I want to get at, see? And you can't do that, setting it up propositionally at the beginning and then bringing proof texts in here. Not in 23 minutes, and not in a way that's going to grab people. It's. I'm trying to paint a picture. I'm trying to tell a story. I'm trying to get a dramatic thing going here that will engage people, just like this movie is making a serious point, apparently. This guy has used this woman, and she's not going to have it. And she's going to get back at him. She's not going to let him use her like he has, one night stand. He's a married guy. He has his fling with this woman. He just wants to have it, have his fun, and then leave. She's saying no. She pursues him. She won't get out of his life. And he can't believe this. You know, we just made love one night. You know, now you just won't get out of my life. And that's a dramatic thing. That grabs, you know, because we've all used people. Maybe not that way, but other ways. So we want to learn from the movies, learn from television, learn how people are engaged, how they're held. And the most boring thing in the world, by and large, there are some, Perry Mason or people like that. But if you've ever been, if you've ever gone to a law court, Dullesville. So to use a legal presentation model for sermonic work, I think, is a big mistake. And yet I know that in many of our very conservative evangelical circles, of which I'm a part, they may not agree with it, that I'm a part of it, but I believe I'm part of it. That is basically the way we preach to teach preaching. And that's what's wrong with so much preaching in the evangelical churches. It is legalistic in its model. It's sequential. It assumes that you can set up a proposition and then prove it. Most of the things we're talking about are not provable. I cannot prove to you that God loves you. I can declare it. That's what I'm doing when I'm preaching. I'm declaring it. I'm proclaiming it. I like the word declare it better. But I can't prove it. I can quote all the scripture going, but it won't prove it to you if you're standing outside the faith. And so what? What difference does it make? So what? He loves me. What does it change? That's the hard thing, is to say, God loves you. And the fact that he loves you makes a big, big difference. What's the difference? That's the preacher's task right there. Very, very tough.
See, that's the missionary's task, too, because I've been in the country where I'm sure you can deeply lay out the gospel and the person will so what?
That's right. Absolutely. And we're not connecting, by and large, in this society. We are connecting with people who still speak a religious language. Most of our evangelical preaching is is effective with people who have come from religious Christian backgrounds, kids or something, and have strayed from the faith. And you can play on their sense of guilt and failure and all that kind of stuff, and you can get them by, you know, talking this language, which they know but have moved away from. But the people that don't even know the language, don't even know the story, don't even know what the heck you're talking about, which is a growing segment of the society, particularly in our big cities, still works in small rural villages and towns by and large, but in big